The session today is Loving Ourselves Toward Maturity, God's Gift of Self-Esteem. And I'm Mona Fote, and this is my husband, Gene. I have the primary responsibility for today when we were talking about how we were going to do this. Those of you who have been in our sessions last week know that we shared responsibility pretty 50-50. But we decided this week that we would take some primary responsibilities, and so I was talking with Gene not about tomorrow's session, but about one, the end of the week, and he had it fairly well planned, and I said, well, what do you want me to do? And he said, well, I could read scripture. So after we laughed about that, he asked me today, what could he do? And I said, well, he could be the chalk person. So that's how we're going to work it out today. It was interesting how our relationship has grown working out last week, but because you know, in a marriage relationship or any intimate relationship, you have to decide who's going to lead and who's going to follow, and that it might be all right at different times. We have a friend who gave a beautiful example of those of you who maneuver canoes, and how you both cannot always be leaders, but that it has to be all right for one person. I don't even know very much about canoeing, but when she talked about it, it just sounded marvelous, and I wish I had it on tape. It was so poetic. We're going to talk today about loving oneself toward Christian maturity, and we're going to be dealing with the issue of self-esteem. Those of you who are coming, if you could sit in the center aisles. I wanted to rearrange this into more of a circle, but it was set up for Vespers, so I decided to leave it. Would you join us here in front? Let us begin with prayer. Heavenly Father, you're the creator of all of us, and you have made us good. You have made us in your own image. You know better than each of us how we struggle daily with the self-esteem issues and how we fail to be creative people because of all the negative thoughts that we have. Help us in this struggle to find ways to look to you, to search ourselves and to find the beauty in each of us that you have created. Be with us now as we talk and share and struggle with this issue. We ask all of this in Jesus' name. Amen. Why don't we begin by defining the whole theme, self-esteem, and the chalk person, it's your turn now. So how about just throwing out some words that you think about when you think about, people call it self-worth, self-esteem. What are some, let's just get a definition of some kind. What? Confidence, okay. Acceptance. Okay. Ego. Any others? Liking yourself. If you were 5 years old, how would you explain this? I'm okay. I did it well, or did it good, or whatever it might be. Okay.
That's my part for the day.
Is it not coming through? There are several definitions that I looked up in preparation. One was one's assessment of the extent to which one is lovable and capable. Another one is how a person feels or thinks about him or herself. We know about God's gift of self-esteem when we read the scriptures. In 1 John 3, 1-3, see what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God, and so we are. The reason why the world does not know us is that it did not know him. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be, but we know that when he appears, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. Another scripture is from 2 Corinthians 5:16 to 19. From now on, therefore, we regard no one from a human point of view. Even though he once regarded Christ from a human point of view, we regard him thus no longer. Therefore, if anyone is in Christ, he is a new creation. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. All this is from God, who through Christ reconciled us to himself and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. And then the third, which we're very familiar with and we have heard a good bit, Matthew 22, 37 to 39. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment. And a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. I think something that really struck me as I was listening last week, particularly to Charlie May's presentation in Hosea. And in Hosea, we hear about Israel's unfaithfulness. And in the sixth chapter, verse 4, there is the following. What shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early away. But later we hear that God says, how can I give up, O Ephraim? How can I hand you over, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zeboiim? My heart recoils within me. My compassion grows warm and tender. And when we have this as a promise, I guess I have to say that we have the most tremendous foundation that we might have in terms of developing a loving feeling about others and certainly a loving feeling about ourselves as God has created us and loves us so much. Laura passed out this. We happen to have some extras from last week and would like to share them with you. Actually, a lot has changed in terms of the sequence that we're going to be presenting this week, but the purpose of our presentation is in a paragraph above the listing. The only thing that we're not going to be doing is session 9, and you'll have to use the bulletin board for when the other areas will be presented. I would like for you to come up later and to look at the books. We particularly want to share that Happily Ever After, some of you are familiar with the Ready, Set, Grow series, which you read to your children. This is the same author. She's written books since then, but she's talking about rearing children in that particular book. One that I will be using in the presentation is a very good book, Self-Esteem, A Family Affair. In this book, on page 3, Jean Clark, who's the author, is saying, why is positive self-esteem important? Well, it's important because when people experience it, they feel good, and they look good, and they're effective, and they're productive. And they respond to other people and themselves in healthy, positive, growing ways. People who have positive self-esteem know that they're lovable and they're capable and that they care about themselves and other people. They do not have to build themselves up by tearing other people down or by patronizing less competent people. Now, she says, positive self-esteem is not to be confused with self-centeredness, being a braggart or acting superior, all of which are attempts to hide negative feelings of self. You're important as long as you act tough, accomplished, or smart is a negative, unhealthy central message around which to organize one's life. You're a worthwhile person is a positive and healthy message. She also shares that she has some particular beliefs about the family which are important. And as we've been talking, we've been emphasizing the family, and certainly our self-esteem has been based a lot on our relationships in families. She says, first of all, that positive self-esteem is important for children and adults, that parents are important people, and so are all other people who care for children. Children are important people, and children deserve caring adults whose needs are met. Effective parenting can be learned by adults of any age. Oh, that's a difficult one. When we gave up extended families, we gave up one kind of a support system, and parents in nuclear families are not assured of a support system, and we need to build new systems. Some parts of our culture are discounting the impact of the addition or loss of a child and child rearing. Example, articles that imply that women working outside the home have more fulfillment than women who are rearing children full time. Or the boss who expects a man to travel out of town the week his baby is due, or their baby is due. The addition of a person by birth, adoption, foster care, or remarriage is a major event in family life, and so is the leaving of any person. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about who contributes to our self-esteem. In the issue by Jean Clark, she suggests that something that is a fixed condition has something to do about that, and she calls it fate. And I was wondering if maybe we could build a list of things that you can think of that really you have nothing to do with. They just happen to you in your life. And I'm wondering, I could start by saying, I really couldn't help it that I have blue-green eyes. What are some other things that might have happened to you in your life that were God's design, and as I said, she uses the word fate. So what would be some examples of that? Who your parents are, okay?
Just being born.
That you were born, okay?
Your height.
Height. How many times have kids said, well, I didn't ask you to have me? That would be the kind of thing. Height. Okay, congenital defect, all right? How about ordinal position? Why wasn't I born last, or why wasn't I born first, or why couldn't I have been in the middle to benefit from both ends? Anything else that comes to mind? The second thing that she suggests that has something to do with our self-esteem is the positive things that happen to us in life. What would be some examples of that? What has happened to you that's positive? A happy home life. Okay, your family of origin. Okay. All right, a Christian and church-going family. All right. So doing well in school and being recognized for it. Maybe having some smarts is part of that. Everything's intact. All systems are go for learning. How about others? Who your friends are. Okay, a support group that you have. Okay, how about on the other side now? She also suggests that fate, positive, and the third thing she suggests is that there's some negative things that can happen to you and that contributes to how we are. So what would be some negative things that have happened that you know about that have happened to other people or have happened to you? What? Death of a parent. And the earlier, maybe the more tragic for you.
Illness.
All right. Alcoholism. Okay. Divorce? What? Loss of a child. Okay. How about loss of a job? Not an inability to get a job. Failure in school. How about going through developmental passages that you were not prepared for? I know as I'm getting older, I'm thinking that menopause is something that women are not prepared for and could be a negative influence in people's lives. Men, I understand, have change of lives now too. So, Okay, now we haven't begun to exhaust the list, but I guess the fourth thing that she says is that we have things that we cannot help. We have positive factors that happen to us. We have negative factors that happen to us. And then the fourth thing is, how do we look at the negative or positive factors that happen to us? You know, you've seen in bookstores, there was a time when you have a lemon, make a lemonade, that some people say a jar or something good is only half empty instead of saying it's half full. Sometimes it has to do with how we look at the negative or positive things that happen to us. You know, Stella Chess has done a lot of work about what happens to children as they are born and how different their personalities are. I know last week as we were talking about small children, several sets of parents came up and said, I'm having a terrible time keeping my hyperactive child still in Vespers. Or they would talk about, why is it that I can sit next to one mother with a child and the child is sitting, you know, shaking a little rattle or something, and another one is all over the place. There's a lot to do with the way we are innately. And some people even feel that when you look at things negatively, that that begins very early. And sometimes they'll say, well, they've just always been that way. Or I know we have the example of Ned's little 9-month-old here, that I have yet to see the child cry. She just responds to you and wants to go to you. And so you wonder, does that have something to do with the chemistry of that family, or does that have something to do with the way that she began life? There is a transactional analysis concept which has been around for quite a while, but it meant a whole lot to me, and that is that we have self-esteem based on two things. One is how we are as human beings, and the second is what we do. And a lot of times in our culture with the work ethic, we have received more strokes, as we say, or more positive attention for what we do. And it's very difficult for many of us to just enjoy being, to have a good time, and to feel that we are not wasting time, but that we are really just enjoying ourselves, enjoying being with other people, and that it's okay to feel lovable in that way, that we don't have to have something to show for it when we finish a transaction. One of my favorite people, perhaps because she is in the same profession than I, Virginia Satir is a psychiatric social worker, and way back when family therapy was just beginning, she wrote one of the first texts on family therapy called Conjoint Family Therapy, and it's a marvelous book. It's actually a series of lectures about what she was saying to people who wanted to be family therapists, and she has a lot to say about self-esteem. Her second book, I believe, was People Making. She's written a lot of other things, some sort of poetry-type books. Some of those I don't completely agree with. But what I do like about her style is she's a very clear writer. And she talks about back in Wisconsin, they had this big old pot on her porch, and that her mother would grow flowers in it one year, and the next year they'd make big family stew out of it, and the third year they would even keep manure in it. And so she called it the 3S pot. And I had a little trouble figuring that out, so I'll pause a minute so that you can understand where the third S comes from. But anyway, what she said is she began to feel as though when she would counsel with people, that they would come to her and they would be very low self-esteem. And she began to think about that pot, that sometimes it was full and sometimes it was half full and sometimes it was very empty. So she began to call people low pot, high pot, and so forth, until she found out that now pot was another word for something else, but she continues to talk about low and high pot. And she has a statement to say here. She says, I'm convinced that the crucial factor in what happens both inside people and between people is the picture of individual worth that each person carries with him and his potential. I'm wondering if you would think just for a moment about how you're doing today, just kind of take check. How did you wake up this morning? How was your pot low? Was your pot high? And how are you feeling right now? Do you notice that sometimes people will say to you, you must really be feeling good, and you want to take that as a compliment, but the only problem with it is you think, well, how was I feeling yesterday if it's so apparent that something has changed? She says that integrity, honesty, responsibility, compassion, love all flow easily from the person whose pot is high. She or he feels that it matters, that the world is a better place because they're there. They have faith in their own competence. They're able to ask others for help, and I think this is really important. So often we pretend that we know it all and have to know it all, and it's a beautiful thing if we can know where our resources are and turn to other people. It's very complimentary to others also. So he's able to ask others for help, but he believes he can make his own decisions and is his own best resource. Appreciating his own worth, he's ready to see and respect the worth of others, and he radiates trust and hope. He doesn't have rules against anything he feels. He accepts all of himself as human. And I guess along with that would go the fact that our feelings do not have judgment with them. And when I found that out for myself, it was just so comforting. I know this morning in the lecture on spirituality, there was the idea that should you be wanting to meditate and your mind goes a mile a minute to all kinds of things, that all of that is the Lord's will also, and that was very comforting to me. And so when I have negative feelings, angry feelings, disappointing feelings, to know that there should be no judgment in that. And that there's always the hope that your life can change because you can learn new things. She continues to say that self-esteem comes from the quality of relationships that we have, that we're psychological mirrors for each other, particularly as parents mirror for children, and they get their beginning messages from us. And that children rarely question our expectations of them, but instead they question their personal inadequacy. She also shares something that I think is interesting about how we develop. And I believe this was more true of how I grew up than perhaps maybe children are growing up. But to talk about this with you perhaps will help you see those of us who are in this age bracket or are somewhat younger, somewhat older. She suggests that as we grew up, it was not all right to see what we saw. And it was not all right to hear what we heard, that there were a lot of family secrets. And it was not all right to feel what we were feeling. That a lot of times, if someone said that they were feeling something, we were told you should not be feeling that way. And so we learned. She suggests we learn from 0 to 20 that we can't see what we see or hear what we hear or feel what we feel. And the fourth thing is that we could not speak in our own behalf. So here we are 20 years. And then it takes us to, let's say, 60 to see that we really saw it, to hear that we really heard it. And then to begin to speak in our own behalf. Well, then here we were too young to, and now we're too old to. And so she's suggesting that as we raise children now, that when they see, you know, why is mother crying? Why are you arguing? Why is dad upset? That we don't say, oh, you know, you've got it all wrong or whatever, but that there are family. There are things that go wrong in relationships, or that daddy's sad, or that Mrs. Jones is upset because she's not getting along well with her husband, or whatever we can do without breaking confidences. That when children say, are you mad?
and you say no, and they say, well, why are you walking that way? That you might say, well, maybe I am a little mad. Because children are learning more and more that they really are seeing things and understanding things, and they do not need to be shoved aside about that. Now, we have another resource that I know has meant a lot to Jean and to me, and that's Sidney Simon. And he has a lovely little book. I'm not sure it's in the bookstore. But he says that every day of our life, we put on a sign. We wake up in the morning, we put the sign on. And the sign stands for, I'm lovable and capable. If I could only tie this. Okay. And that, you know, we're going along and something happens at home. Well, let's say the alarm doesn't go off and we're late. And so we tear off a little bit of the sign and we're thinking, oh, now we're in a hurry because we had a whole lot to do before noon at work and we're late. Someone comes in and fusses at us and we tear off a little with our sign. Then maybe if we're lucky or if we have supportive people, you know, someone might say something good, so we kind of patch that up a little bit. And then let's say we hear we didn't, you know, get the raise we thought we were going to get, or we stepped on the scale, and Lord knows this is a big one, so I'm going to take that one off. And, you know, your husband may call you and say that you took both sets of keys to the car, and he's sitting at home waiting, you know, to go to the meeting or whatever. And then maybe someone even says something to you about their home situation, but you begin to think, well, that might apply to mine. Maybe I'm not such a good whatever either. And, you know, someone is a real fuss, naggy kind of person in a restaurant or in a store. And so, I mean, I have something on here I don't want to destroy on the back, but sometimes our little sign by the end of the day is so tiny and the little, right, we have this little thing that says, I'm lovable and capable. What is suggested how we can be of help in terms of continuing to have a big sign and to build our own self-esteem, particularly in the self-esteem of family affair, she's suggesting that we have supportive people around us and that we actually build a supportive system for ourselves. I know in transactional analysis they even go and they have names for all of it, like who are your 10 most supportive friends, but they have gimmicky names to remember it. But it is true that if we surround ourselves with negative input and negative vibrations, then that's what our food is going to be, our psychological food. And so you all know why you choose certain friends. I think probably because they just very much like you for who you are. Not so much what you can do, but because of the people that you are. And you can just think for a moment about the people that you have as friends and those that you find yourself going to see more often or inviting over or suggesting that they go places with you because they're supportive friends and they truly affirm you. What I'd like for you to do is I would like for you to think of one of the things that's on your sign that is a positive thing, something that one of your patch-up jobs. I'd like for you to think of one thing that you do well, and maybe it should be in terms of being, not so much in doing, not like I knit well or I fix engines well, but a way that you are, that you know, the being part of you. And I'd like for you to turn to the person next to you and say that. Now, the person next to you is going to have the harder task. I have the... you have some choices of response. This is so easy. You don't even have to think, those of you who are responding to it, because I'm going to give you some choices. One thing you can say is you really did do that well. And a third one could be, you know you're right. So the first task is to turn to someone who is near you and say something that you do well. The person listening to it is just to use one of these responses. And then, of course, it's going to be that the person who gave the response needs to think of something, and then you say the response. And let's just see how this feels. You kind of need to get together, those of you who are apart. Okay, ready, set, go. Okay, now have you reversed it so the other person has shared? Have all of you reversed it? Okay. So how common was that language? Wasn't very common?
Strange.
Were you feeling like a braggart? Were you? Mm-hmm. How did it feel to give affirmation like that? What?
1 year 3 wasn't always
right. Okay. What? Oh, really? Fantastic. Your life must be pretty special. I guess I'm thinking that although we may not do this to one another, which it's really a shame that we don't have more affirmation of one another, but do you do it for yourselves? How is it that we begin to be more negative than positive? What happens to us in our daily lives that we begin to forget? There was this fancy title, a stroke buffet. How about that? A buffet or a potluck maybe where you had heard the things about you that you really do admire and feel that good about. Do each of you have a stroke buffet when you begin to feel someone has said something negative about you? And I guess there's several choices. One is you can take it in and you can say, oh, they're right, I do it all the time. Another way you can say, oh, they're, you know, who are they? Or another way that you can do it is you can take it out here where you have some distance from it and you'll say, that's a thought or that's a criticism, I'll take a look at it. But hold it out from you and then make some decisions about whether it fits or not. So what happens that we get so down on ourselves all the time? Any ideas about that? Sydney Simon also wrote a book, I've forgotten the title of it, Vultures, is that the title? Vultures. Now he says we have a red pencil climate, and that is that whenever we do anything, we approach it like the English teacher does with the red pencil. And in fact, one of our sons had such a teacher, and she indeed used red pencil. And I noticed he wrote a paper that wasn't bad. I read parts of it, but on the side she had utterly ridiculous about certain concepts he had. And although, you know, he knew his paper wasn't perfect, to be utterly ridiculous, particularly if they were comments, comments that had judgment based on, you know, his own thinking. So if we grow up in that kind of red pencil. Well, anyway, back to the vultures. What he says happens is every day we allow these vultures to come and just sort of do what I did to my Iolax sign, but that they eat away at us, and we allow those to happen. And he then suggests in this very little book some ways to combat the vultures that we have. Any other ideas about how we get so crazy about the positive and negative? I know I was telling Kathy Myers that one thing that helps me, and it seemed like this week I was more uptight than usual because I was out of our state, and I wondered if parents thought the same way they do here as in Texas, and maybe everything I was going to say everybody knew and didn't want to hear again or whatever. But if I could find some friendly face in the audience that I thought was going to give me some kind of feedback that would be warm, you know, I'd kind of look for that, and it helped me be less nervous. And, you know, they might have just had a paralysis where the smile was on or something, but I didn't care. It was what I needed, you know, to get going. And but anyway, another thing that Sid Simon says is that we are touch hungry. And I noticed that here at Holden, it seems like it's sort of epidemic that there's a lot of touching, and that maybe because of the building relationships on the staff, you know, they build through the months, and that there are more hugs. I think that in San Antonio, you know, if you had a group of friends, you would not see as much touching and hugging. He says that every human being comes into this world needing to be touched, and the need for skin contact persists into death, despite society's efforts to make us believe otherwise.
being touched in ways which are respectful, aware, and tenderly full of caring can be healing, one of the most therapeutic things a person can experience. And there's confusion between the ways and means of touching because of our emphasis on sexual arousal. In thousands of homes, children or people are rarely touched, if ever touched. I noticed that in nursery schools, the teachers often will stoop to make eye contact with the children, and they do a lot of touching. And you think about these little infants, and like the infant that is here, 6 weeks old, and you think about people with negative concepts, and you wonder what happens in between this phase of when children are so very small and so very vulnerable, and then we become adults. And Virginia Satir has a list of things which she thinks go into building a good self-esteem. We're going to come back to touching, but I'd like to share this with you. She said that one thing that's important is that parents or people around children need self-esteem. Otherwise, the parents will expect their child to enhance their own self-esteem. And don't we see this over and over when we want our children to succeed? You know, the stage mother, I know I was one, wanting to do all the things that with my child that I never got to do. In fact, the kids tease me when I sit down to the piano that I cannot play and sing the songs that I cannot sing, that I should rent Carnegie Hall for one night and just do it up so that the family didn't have to hear all the renditions. When children come into the world, their constitutional differences make a difference, yet all children come into the world helpless. Whatever they require for survival must be given to them or taught to them, and this comes from the people with whom they live, the survival figures, he calls us. Children need physical comfort. They need continuity in relationships. They need the same person giving him warmth and food, touching and talking to him, trust and predictability. A child needs to learn how to influence and predict the responses of others. And I think I work in a mental health center. Did I ever say who I was? I did. All right. Well, anyway, I work in a mental health center. I'm aware I need this on the tape, Mona folk. When children have unpredictable responses, those are real crazy-making situations. When a child comes up to a parent and expects to be loved and they get slapped in the face, or when there are double bind messages continually being given to children and they do not have a predictable environment, then that's how you end up with schizophrenic children and emotionally disturbed children. So they need some predictability. And that's what this says. A child needs to learn how to influence and predict the responses of others. When he cries, food and warmth usually come, sometimes not. Some cries work better than others, but smiles work real well. A child needs to learn how to structure the world. He learns how to differentiate between the world of himself as he gets a little bit older in his months, his father and his mother, and he adds cats and dogs and friends and non-friends. This expands his knowledge of how to evaluate and to predict. A child needs to esteem himself as a masterful person and a sexual person. By noticing his growth, communicating about it, increasing opportunities to expand it, doing more for himself and making more decisions. And I think our work last week regarding problem solving and children early learning, you know, to make decisions. I know at 3, 4, they can make beautiful decisions. I remember Laura learned something about tying her shoe. She was in this snit about it, and I couldn't figure out how to do it to suit her, but she figured out a new way, and I thought, oh, wow, this is terrific. She, knew what her own problem was and was able to solve it very early. To validate a child for age-appropriate behavior and not 8-year-old behavior expected for 4-year-olds. And I know, particularly with firstborn children, it seems like, you know, we want them to have it all together by age 3. And I know I will say to parents sometimes, well, you know, I'm still working on that, and I'm in my 40s, and so there's some more time, you know, and they're fussing at age 4. They don't know how to share or all those good things. What I'd like for us to do now is to go back to Sid Simon's idea about touching, and I'd like for us to form a real big circle around this center, whatever this is, row of chairs. Would you please form a big circle? I'm going to give you instructions. I promise this is not harmful. You don't have to kiss anybody. Okay, get a little more comfort if you can. Okay, all of you turn to the right. Can't they all do that? Okay, and I'd like for you to drop hands. And I'd like for you to put your hands on the shoulders of the person in front of you. Get comfortable with that. Okay. You're going to have to move up, and then they're going to have to move over. Mark, move forward. Go. Okay. Okay, how about massaging away the tiredness of the shoulder? You're going to need to get close. Okay. Okay, don't say anything. Just rub the tiredness and fatigue from the person in front of your shoulder. Now wind down and let your hands come to rest, but don't take them away. And slowly ease your hands off and turn around to reciprocate to the person. Okay? So take away the tiredness and fatigue from the person's shoulder. In thousands of homes everywhere, many, many people are never touched in one day. Now gently wind down, but leave your hands on the person's shoulder. And then say thank you to each other and sit down. Okay, let's...
How do you get that
if you're
not getting it?
Huh?
If you're an adult and you want that and you're not getting it, how do you go about doing it?
Okay, he's asking you, if you don't get it, how could you go about getting it? Are you talking about touch or affirmation in general?
Which is an affirmation?
Do we have any Italian friends? How about a German Lutheran friend? Do you think you could teach them? Or? Be very hard. Okay. How else can you get what you think that you are missing for this touching or affirmation? Okay. Isn't that true? A lot of times people say, "Will you do this?" And so I know my mother's good at that. She'll say, "Let me massage your shoulders." When I think really what she is asking is, "Would you mind massaging?" Because she'll be going like this as she's doing it. And it's really not a hint so directly, but I do know that it feels very good, and probably she would like for me to reciprocate. What? Yes. Last week, or I think it was Saturday, we turned to one another and said, "Would you listen to me just for a few moments?" And that was so awkward for people to actually ask for what they wanted. But asking, that's... What? A hug. Right.
I noticed quite a difference, at least in our group, with the new liturgy and sharing things, where people are now first quite standoffish and formal with it, and now it's become something you almost look forward to. And for those of us that come to Holden, it's much more than those who have been here.
I know in...
You want to demonstrate the host?
I've forgotten them all. Sydney Simon says there are different kinds of hugs. One is the pocket hug. Like I don't know.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah. You just sort of try not to get too close.
That's it. Then there's the tent hug.
Well, that tent hug or A-frame, right? That's
A-frame.
And then there's just the hug.
You may not want to give a full body hug to everyone, but I think there's another one which we miss. Anything else you'd like to share? I swore that I'd leave some time for discussion the last times we've run over. Anything else would you like to ask something? Well, it doesn't really matter if this is... anything else that the whole issue of self-esteem has stirred up in you in terms of your own family situation? Good. I think it does not mean that there is not room for criticism. I think that's where the whole, that's a big one, and we aren't talking a lot about that. But can you continue to feel all right if you are criticized and someone would say, I don't like that blouse on you, Mother? Well, I do. I plan to wear it, or I plan to. I know I tease my family. I'll say, well, I'm this way, and I plan to stay that way. Especially if it's something that is not affecting them. But they can say, I don't like the wide leg pants you have. They went out in the 50s or whatever. Or I can say I choose to wear them rather than to buy some new ones until they wear out or whatever.
How about when you see that just the criticisms are given in a positive way, like you did look better
Well, how would it feel for you if I said, I really like the blouse you had on yesterday better than the one you have on today? How would that feel for you? I think that would just depend on the person, how it would feel.
Okay. Sincerity and criticism, though, is something that's important.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some people who put it on and it's fake. Mm-hmm. And it's grabs nothing.
That's how I got started using Amway. Someone said to me, do you do your husband's shirts? And I said, yes. Well, they are remarkably white. And I said, well, thank you. I never paid much attention to shirts and so forth. And then come to find out she wanted to sell me Amway to make them whiter. But, she got me into talking about how I did it, and then come to find out she does it differently, and don't I want to come and have some of that, and so forth. I've been using it ever since, 20 years now or so, but it was kind of in the back door. We need to stop now. Let's see, tomorrow at 4 o'clock, we are going to be talking about roles in a family. And we're going to use some of the Virginia Satir communication patterns, and I think it will be a lot of fun. We're going to be doing some things regarding how communication styles get started in families. Then we're going to be talking a little later in the week about families get older also, and then there's a family forum tonight at 9 o'clock with Ted Peters and the two of us talking about the family and whether the congregation or society is aware of the family and has programming around it and all the issues. We raised a lot of issues last night, and so we'll be continuing some of those.